Save big on your next project right now at Menards. Save time on your paint project with help from Duck Clean Release Painter's Tape. Use on walls, trim, glass, wood, or metal for clean removal and clean paint lines every time. Save big and get a 3-pack of Duck Clean Release Painter's Tape on sale now through September 22nd. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Through the Griffin Tour is back, and this time we are heading to the West Coast. Join Jay and I as we record brand new episodes of the show live in person with you guys, plus a special in-person Jay versus Ben with questions asked by... This September, we will be heading to Seattle, Portland, Sacramento, Berkeley, San Diego, and Los Angeles. Seattle and San Diego were both sold out, but we've just added matinee shows to both locations. So if you missed out on the first pass, or if you want to join us for a doubleheader, we will have two unique shows in the same day. For us, there is nothing more fun than getting to nerd out Harry Potter style with each and every one of you. And we will also have exclusive Through the Gryffindor merch and a VIP meet and greet available for every show. We hope to see you all there. Ticket links can be found in the show notes or at supercarlinbrothers.com.
Welcome, dear listeners. I'm Jonathan Carlin.
And I'm Benjamin Carlin.
And we invite you to join us through the Griffin Door, your one-way ticket to the enchanting world of Harry Potter. So grab your wands and dust off your broomsticks and join us as we unlock the mysteries behind Prisoner of Azkaban, Chapter 15, The Quidditch Final.
Boy howdy. Yeah. I need to go back. I need to make some reparations.
For a
comment that I previously made on the chapter otherwise known as Gryffindor versus Ravenclaw.
Yeah.
Where I think I was like, I think this is the best chapter of Quidditch in the entire series. And I'm wrong because this might be the best chapter of
Quidditch in
the entire series.
This is really the best Quidditch book in the series,
without a doubt. It's the best Quidditch book in the series.
Yeah.
I think I underestimate in Chamber of Secrets. I'm pretty sure we only see one Quidditch match?
Is that right? Let's see, because the last one against Ravenclaw gets canceled. So is that right? Gosh, now I can't remember.
There's
the Rogue Bludger.
The Rogue Bludger. We know that one. Is that against Slytherin?
Yeah, that's against Slytherin.
Okay.
And then when is the Hufflepuff match? They must have it.
You'd think.
Yeah.
I feel like I was doing research for our video last week and I was like, hang on a second, is there only one? Do we only know of one match? Anyway, it doesn't really matter because this is a superb chapter of Quidditch. Prisoner, I do think, takes the cake for the best Quidditch book that we get.
Well, because in, you know, Goblet of Fire, you just have the Quidditch World Cup. You don't have any Hogwarts Quidditch.
Right. And the Quidditch World Cup is very interesting because you do get to see, like, Quidditch at, like, the professional scale.
Yeah.
Which is kind of fun and, like, the spectacle that it is. And you got Victor Krum, who's, like, you know, the ultimate seeker. And there's sort of the unusual circumstance of, you know, Ireland wins, but the, you know, Bulgaria catches the snitch.
Yeah.
So, like, it you know, we've never really seen an instance before where the snitch capture didn't also coincide with victory.
Yes. Yeah. So that's, and this, that it happens at, like, the world scale is extra interesting.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's like the Super Bowl going into, like, four overtimes or something. It's like,
right,
what is happening right now?
What goes here? Yeah. But then, like, in Order, that's when Umbridge is there and Harry doesn't get to play.
Yes.
And then in Half-Blood Prince, it feels like it's, you know, it's there, but it's all, like, you know, social political backdrop for, like, the love triangles and stuff.
For sure. Yeah. For sure. And it even seems like at that point in time, as much as, like, Quidditch has been, like, one of Harry's, like, you know, all-time favorite, like, things, it's like riding a broomstick for the first time is, like, his first ever Patronus memory. Like, you know, clearly his affinity for the sport is great. But I think that as can sometimes be the case, like, sports are the most important unimportant thing.
Of course.
And I think at that point in Harry's life, the important thing things are really starting to take major precedent over the unimportant ones.
But I do like, though, because like this is the last time they will play Quidditch before Voldemort comes back.
Oh, you're right.
Right.
How about that?
That's crazy.
That is crazy to think about.
Yeah. So then what I like, though, is that the fact that Quidditch continues and remains important to Harry, even if it's not as focal to the story, is that it's very much what like Dumbledore eventually says about like, you know, of children's stories and house elves and candy and whatever. Like Voldemort knows none of that importance. And like Quidditch, sports, games, that falls into that sentiment.
I agree.
Of like Quidditch must remain important to everybody because Quidditch being important to people, despite the circumstances, is exactly the point.
Yes, yes. It's like these are people who are still able to go out and have recreational enjoyment together, coming together over, again, what you can argue is an otherwise unimportant thing, but very fun thing.
Yes.
Which defies what Voldemort stands for, which is spectacular. But honestly, I think even this chapter a little bit, people all the time talk about Prisoner being their favorite book.
Yeah.
Oftentimes it's people's favorite movie as well. And I always feel like I'm a little bit in the minority on this one where I tend to not like necessarily resonate at that same frequency where it's not the one that I usually think as like my favorite or even second favorite.
Right.
I think I was reading this chapter on, you know, this is now Monday morning as we're recording, but we're reading it, you know, afternoon on Friday, and I was having so much fun. I was like, okay. Like this is, like when you slow down and you're not like powering through these reads like we so often do for theory writing, and you just like sit inside of the story and enjoy yourself, like I don't know, I this to me was a superb chapter for that. Like I really just had fun.
It's just a fun chapter.
Yes.
Yeah, all around. Yeah, so I do love that about it. And then we got to talk about the chapter art here because it's some pretty good one.
Yes. I gave it a 100 out of 10.
A 100 out of 10.
Yes.
Fantastic. I absolutely love it. I agree with your rating. It does, like, personally, you'll notice, Ben, that we get to see the Firebolt depicted here. And I don't want to like point fingers or anything, but there's a glorious lack of footrests on this Firebolt. There is some sparkles. It looks fast. I love it. So I'll just point that out. You know, it's right there. I will also say though, I'll also point out that despite getting the broomstick absolutely right, I feel like the way Harry is dressed looks a little silly.
It's giving capes.
He's got a cape.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like robes. It looks like he's wearing some like Adidas down there. Not real like wizard shoes. He looks like he's maybe wearing jeans. So it's hard, you know, the broom, 1 million out of a million. Harry's outfit, just a regular 10 out of 10.
Okay.
Which I understand is both 100%. But I think you know what I mean.
Some infinities are larger than others.
Some infinities are larger than others. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I get you.
But otherwise, we got Harry reaching for the snitch. There's a bludger coming in. There's the Firebolt. I mean, there's a lot happening in this picture. It's a great one.
Yeah. A picture is worth 1,000 words. And this one tells that. So I think it's a lot of fun. I even love the fact that the bludger is swooping in. And that is, in fact, like as the snitch capture happens, like it is accurately depicting like you got the two hands off the broom.
Right. Like you know, it's not just like a dynamic picture.
It's not just a dynamic picture. It is actually showing you what will happen.
Yeah.
And so that's a lot of fun. So, and I think this is one of those rare occasions as well. Like it seems like when it came to chapter art, either the publishers, the artists, you know, whoever was involved with making these decisions, it oftentimes feels as though they are like really, really, really worrying about giving things away inside of the artwork itself. And on occasion you end up getting like real weird like mismatches where it's like, why is that the chapter art for this chapter? Because it doesn't really seem like it's accurately depicting what we're about to see. But in this instance, I think it works really well because even though Harry's like fingertips away, it's like the bludger is also sweeping in. And so it's like, it's the Quidditch final. You can see that Harry will be close to the snitch, but because that bludger's there and because like both hands are off the broom, it's like you don't know which is going to strike first.
Right.
So it's like it's giving you like the idea. It's like, well, every time Harry's ever been close to the snitch before, he's pretty much caught it.
Yeah.
However, we have circumstance to believe like, you know, like it's a 50-50. We don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
So it's fun because it's showing you a lot without giving the ending away.
It is. Boy, it occurs to me now, like when like whenever I think about like the idea of playing Quidditch, yeah. I'm like, I probably wouldn't get hit by a bludger. Like, how, what are the odds? Like, they seem pretty inaccurate. You got people trying to avoid it on your behalf. Like, it's not, you know, and I bet that's true. Like, obviously this is a fictional sport, but I bet like 90% of the time that's true. You don't really have to worry about getting hit by the bludgers. You right. can dodge them or whatever. But I think about like mountain biking, and it's like, you know what? To mountain bike is to crash eventually.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yeah. If you keep going, eventually you're probably going to find yourself traveling clean over those handlebars.
Right. Like no professional Quidditch player has ended their career without getting smacked by one of those bludgers.
Right.
Like
right.
that happens. And if, you know what? Per game, if no one's getting hit by a bludger, what are the beaters even doing? You know?
Yeah, their jobs, just, Jay. Their jobs.
But only half of their jobs.
Well, I guess that's fair. Know? Yeah. Are you have to think of as the beaters as either offense or defense.
Yeah.
You know, are they protecting their players or attacking the other players?
Right.
Yeah.
It seems like it would, to me, if I was coaching, I would say way more focus on the defense.
Agreed.
Just make sure your players don't get hit. If you have the opportunity to hit one of them, go for it. But that's not like your goal.
I know. Well, and it seems like if you go offensive with it, it could become rather dangerous rather quickly, because the possibility of your player being nearby to someone else's player,
yeah.
especially if you're trying to like interrupt play.
Yeah.
Like let's say you have two chasers speeding down, you know, the pitch side by side, and you're like, okay, I want to knock my guy free of the competitor there. It's like you run the risk of accidentally hitting a cannonball at your own player.
Right.
And so it's like it's a high risk, high reward. And if the circumstances dictated it's going to be a top 10 highlight, you know, on that night's ESPN.
Oh yeah.
You know, if you successfully take the risk and it works.
Well, there is some high skill bludger play that happens in this chapter.
Yeah, there is indeed.
So we'll get to that. We'll get to that. But maybe we should go ahead and dive on in here.
I know. Yeah.
Before
we
get into the, you know, narrow strategies of a fictional sport.
Well, you know, I mean, it's like, what else are we supposed to do with our time if not
that? Exactly.
Okay. So one of the things I think is really interesting as we dive into chapter 15, the Quidditch final, is that the chapter itself picks up with the very next sentence from where the last chapter ended.
Yeah, like no time passes.
No time passes whatsoever. So what we have last left with is Hermione approaching the boys. Ron is still being pretty mean to her. And Hermione is basically just saying, like, I thought you ought to know that Hagrid lost his case. Buckbeak is going to be executed. Then we pick up this chapter right away with, he sent me this, Hermione said, holding out the letter. So sometimes I think that the Potter series, we constantly have that, like, the thing where it's like Voldemort always attacks at the end of the year because you have to like let so much time pass. And like there are huge swaths of time where like Harry is just going to school and things are just regular and nothing is happening.
Right. It'll be like, it was Christmas. And then the next chapter will be like, it was a cold February morning. And you're like, oh, January just happened, I guess.
Yes. Well, yeah. Good for Harry. You know, he's got to have like a normal just
regular, did his homework and learned some spells, I guess. I don't know.
Yes.
Right.
So we only hear about things when things are happening. But this is an instance where no time passages at all. So I think that was something that kind of like caught my eye. I was like, oh wow, okay.
Yeah.
We're right there.
What's interesting about that too is like so often the cliffhangers at the end of the chapters are like very, like, you know, they're very well set up so that you're like, I gotta find out what happens.
Right.
But like coming out of the last chapter, like I feel like even as a kid, where it's like Hermione's holding up the letter, says Buckbeak's going to be executed. And it's like, I don't mind, like I like Buckbeak. Buckbeak's great, but like part of me is like, no, not gonna happen.
Like, even
young me is like, that's not gonna happen.
There's no way they're gonna put him on the cover.
Right. Yeah. It's like, I don't think that's gonna happen. And it's also like, I think it's the plot line I care the least about.
Is
the Buckbeak one. It's just like, I know it's important for Sirius's escape and the time turner, and like it all comes together very nicely, but I'm just like, Buckbeak's gonna be executed. I feel like I could be like, all right, that's a good stopping point.
You know what?
I will put my book down, which is a shame because the next chapter's so fun.
I know, yeah. Not the time to do it. Maybe that's what they knew. They were like, okay, well, people aren't going to be that invested. We're going to give them like a really good Quidditch chapter.
Yep.
So anyway, we do get the letter from Hagrid, which at least our version of the story here has the actual smudges from Hagrid's tears all over the page. Yeah, it's a nice touch for the publishing. So we have, Dear Hermione, we lost him. Allowed to bring him back to Hogwarts. Execution date to be fixed. Beaky has enjoyed London, to which I just put like a sad sad face because, like, it's so sad to think of Buckbeak just perusing the streets of London, which, how? Like the streets of the Muggle streets of London, or
Muggle
the
streets of London,
Diagon Alley,
or just like looking out the night bus from your bed,
right? No. Yeah.
Guess you got them there. Okay.
True. I won't forget all the help you gave us, Hagrid. Which, goodness gracious, I mean, that's just it's a letter that'll hit you in the feels.
It does. Yeah. So that's a real bummer. And then, you know, Harry and Ron immediately realize the severity of the situation. And finally, it seems like something breaks in Ron and he's like, oh man, now I can forgive you.
Yes, I know. We talked a lot about it in last week's episode, and I thought the feedback that we got was hilarious, where people were talking about how in chapter 14, Harry and Ron are just like, they're not at their best. And we basically chalk it up to, like, you know what? Sometimes 13-year-olds, not at their best.
Yeah.
And it was really funny to see the feedback where people were like, I love how so many plot holes are like well-researched and beautifully written and, you know, carefully put together. And other times it's just, they were 13. And so, yeah, sure enough, it was a tough chapter, last chapter, but the boys do, I think, start their journey to redemption here, where Hermione is sort of, suggesting that there will be an appeal, but, you know, nothing will likely have changed. And Ron is basically like, yeah, it will. You won't have to do all the work alone this time, Hermione. I'll help. And you're like, okay, that a boy, Ron.
Yay.
Welcome back to the party.
Welcome back.
Pal.
Oh, yeah. Dude, you're right. About speaking on like the plot hole thing, and sometimes it's just they're 13. It's like my least favorite trope is when in like fantasy books, or really any whatever nonfiction I'm reading, is when the character will basically gaslight themselves into a plot problem, like, and that's their reasoning behind things.
Oh.
They'll be like, it's my fault they died, and it'd be like, it is not your fault that person told their dragon to burn this person. It's but I could have stopped them three chapters ago. And it's like, no, like, it's still not your fault.
Yeah.
And it's like, but like, this will be, and I think it's frustrating because without a doubt, eventually the character will realize it, but this will be their motivation for like books sometimes. Yes. And you're just like, this doesn't even make sense.
I know.
It's so annoying. And like, I know how they're going to realize that it wasn't their fault. And that's just like, it feels like, you know what the resolution will be immediately. And it's just like, but anyway, that's all.
No,
I just wanted to say that.
I follow your meaning though. I do know that trope. And it is like one of these things where it's like, come on.
Like, just figure it out.
We need a better reason for the character to be motivated than just like, poorly appointed guilt.
Yes. Guilt, like misplaced guilt on themselves.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then, from there we do have so Ron basically has stepped back up to the plate. He's saying that he's going to help out. They kind of have like a awkward moment, Hermione and Ron do, but it does feel a little bit like a Ron Hermione moment.
I literally wrote Ron Hermione. I feel like this is it. This is the start.
I know. Yeah.
I think this is the start.
Like the proper start. Yeah.
Yes.
So basically we get Hermione flung her arms around Ron's neck and broke down completely. Ron, looking quite terrified, patted her very awkwardly on the top of the head, which is like, so something like, I can just picture something happening.
Right. Yeah. It's like Ron, it reads like Ron has never even considered the idea of like dating anyone ever at this point. And he's just like, oh my God, a girl's touching me. What's happening?
Whoa, yeah.
Hello? Yeah, cool. You're welcome.
Yeah, right. Yes. Yeah. Very, very awkward. All of a sudden, like, he's very in his head about like, what am I supposed to do in this situation? We finally get a little bit of resolution to the Scabbers situation, which honestly, similar to your point from before, like Ron being so upset about Scabbers is another one of those where it's like, it's not like a misplaced guilt situation, but it's like, Ron, there's no way you cared that much. There's no way. But,
and it's like, you can tell like what he's not even as of this sentence, these two paragraphs, it's like, I don't think he's like that upset about Scabbers. He seems more upset that Hermione won't like like take his side on it.
Right, right.
Like, it's like is like showing no understanding or compassion.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But it's like then I love this because like the moment she shows compassion, he's like, yeah, he was pretty old.
Right.
He
right,
was like, yeah, you know, I don't know why I was so upset.
I know. Yeah. He even says like, yeah, you never know, mom and dad might get me an owl now. And I was like, how is this not just like where your head went in the first place?
Right.
Like,
right. You probably could have parlayed that dead rat into an owl pretty quickly. You know.
Yeah, it seems at least somewhat possible.
Right.
Yeah. So, but I don't know. Maybe this is just like that classic instance where sometimes in life, all you need is just like a little bit of validation from the person you want it from.
Yep,
like,
this is what I wrote down was forgiveness begets forgiveness. And it's just like,
yep.
There you go. Just yes. This, I like this.
Yes. Yep. Yep. There you go. Goodness. So, let's see here. So then we scoot forward a little bit, and Harry, Ron, and Hermione are able to talk to Hagrid a little bit about what happened during their Care of Magical Creatures lesson, where Hagrid sort of he kind of like lets you know a little bit about like. I mean, it feels like classic Hagrid a little bit, like his heart's in all the right places, but like, I think under pressure, especially from like people who seem like so important and are looking down on him and stuff, he, you know, he was dropping his notes. He was forgetting all the things that Hermione looked up for him. Like, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, maybe Hagrid needed like a hippogriff lawyer.
He 1,000% did. Actually, speaking of the exact gaslighting yourself thing, thankfully Harry, Ron, and Hermione are here to, not let Hagrid get away with this, but literally he comes back and he says, it's all my fault.
Yeah.
Got all tongue tied. It's like, no, it is Malfoy's fault. None of this is your fault. Stop it.
Right. Yes, like, you were teaching an interesting lesson. You correctly told him how to handle the creatures. Malfoy did not listen to that particular thing and then faked an injury for 3 full months.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and not to mention at the very top of the page, it says that Malfoy's dad frightened the committee into convicting him or whatever.
Yeah.
And to which I wrote, like, just how corruptible is everyone, like, which I'm sure is one of those sentences that like everybody in the world is like, Ben, everybody is corruptible.
Everybody's there,
yeah. But like, my cynicism doesn't want to extend that far.
Yeah.
Where I'm just like, can everyone just be bought?
Just seems like it.
And like, to what, I mean, to me, this even seems like Lucius would, it'd be like, Lucius, this is a poor use of your money. Like,
right.
It's like, you're paying these people off so that your son wins a small battle against someone who his schoolyard rivals, favorite teacher values. Like,
I know,
you
know, right?
It's like, this is such a convoluted mess. It's so stupid.
I know. It's like the end result of this isn't even that Hagrid's going to get fired. It's just that Buckbeak is going to be killed.
Right.
Right. Yeah. It's like you accomplish nothing.
I like to think that after his days of writing, being an author, that Newt's commander just becomes like a nighttime vigilante and goes and like pranks the Malfoy Manor, you know, by just doing silly little things. But he's like,
gosh.
If you're going against the hippogriff for literally no reason at all, it's like, oh, it's on.
It is the on, sir. Yeah,
I'm letting in a rumpant loose in your peacock field or something. No, because he wouldn't want to hurt the peacocks. But you know
that's
what I mean.
True. I know what you mean.
Something of the sort.
I also love as they're, before they go down to Hagrid, it says, the safety measures imposed on the students since Black's second break-in made it impossible for Harry, Ron, and Hermione to go and visit Hagrid in the evenings. And it's like, yeah, they can't make it down to Hagrid's house, but everyone's still allowed to go to Hogsmeade. You know?
Naturally.
Like, yeah.
Safety.
Safety. Yeah. Safety. Yeah. You can't travel inside the grounds. No. Outside, totally fine.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Not our problem anymore.
Right. Sure enough. Why not?
Sure enough. Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
Let's see here. So then we have another instance of Malfoy, who basically has found the well of humor that is seemingly incapable of being sucked dry, because him, Crabbe, and Goyle keep looking back at Harry, Ron, and Hermione just laughing derisively.
Yeah.
Which it's like, guys, do you have anything better to do with
they
your
like
time?
They just don't. It's just like there must be more interesting things happening. But no, but then comes just the best.
You could have added an "is" to the end of that. Next comes just "is."
Next comes justice, and one of the best scenes in the book and in the movies, possibly better in the movies. But amazing in the book, nonetheless. Harry and Ron made furious moves towards Malfoy, but Hermione got there first. Smack! Just like, yes. Oh, so like it feels like you've been waiting for three books for this to happen.
I know. Yes. It was actually completely comical because somehow, some way, I did not recall that this was the scene where this happened. So three lines prior where Malfoy goes, what says, Hagrid turned around and hurried back towards his cabin, his face buried in his handkerchief. Malfoy says, look at him, blubber. And I literally wrote a note before reading the next three lines and said, please someone punch him.
Oh.
And then like two lines later, it's like smack. I was like, oh yeah, there we go. It happened.
Bam. Oh my gosh. So good. And I love how just absolutely flabbergasted everyone is by the fact that it's Hermione who does it. It just hits him straight across the face. Like Harry, Ron, Crabbe, and Goyle are all just like, what do we do?
What do we do? Well, and that's the thing too, is that like, I think everybody kind of in the moment, and it says like, Hermione, said Ron weakly, and he tried to grab her hand as she swung it back. Get off, Ron. And then it says, Hermione pulled out her wand.
Yeah.
To which I highlighted and I was like, who's laughing now, Malfoy?
Oh, I know. Like at his core, he knows she's dangerous.
Oh yes. Yeah. Yes. It's like, you were relying on the fact that she is kinder than you this whole time.
Yes.
And now she has snapped, and the most formidable person in your year is about to destroy you.
Absolutely what's happening. It reminds me so much of hilariously, well, here it's Ron who's holding her back. I feel like the next time you see Hermione really snap like this is when Ron returns in Deathly Hallows. Yeah. So she's like, Harry, where is my wand? You
know? Yes. Yeah. It's like, there is a version of Hermione that can be pushed too far and the outcomes are the same.
Yeah.
You're so right. That's a good callback for Deathly Hallows.
Yeah.
Or a call forward, maybe.
Call forward, yeah.
So anyway, yeah. So a truly tremendous moment for Hermione in all of this. And to which she says, Harry, you better beat him in the Quidditch final. And somehow, of all people, Ron remembers that they're doing charms.
Yeah. We have the hug from Hermione earlier apologizing about Scabbers. And then like Ron watches her punch Malfoy. And like this, when it says Ron's still goggling Hermione, I'm like, this is it. This is where Ron starts to fall in love.
I highlighted the same thing. And yeah, I says,
right there.
Was this a big moment for them?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah, like this is like all of a sudden Ron is like, he's like looking at her through like a brand new lens.
I know.
Wow. Is that great skin you've got?
Oh man. That's fantastic. Also I think speaking of like call forwards here, we have when Hermione's like finally restrained, she's saying, you know, you better beat him in that Quidditch final. You had just better, because I can't stand it if Slytherin wins. So if you fast forward a few years, Ginny is going to be accusing Hermione of never properly understanding Quidditch.
Oh, you know? Right.
And I'm like, I think she's wrong about that.
But, and this might be like one of those things where it's like, it's not that Hermione doesn't understand, she just doesn't care that much.
Yeah.
But maybe she does understand. But no, you're right. That is really funny because it's like the first ever moment where like Ginny and Hermione have beef.
Yeah.
And it's over Quidditch.
Yeah. Yeah. But here, at least back in year three, Hermione is invested in the Quidditch final.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then from there, they do make it to Flitwick's class, where you kind of get like another one of these good time turner moments where Flitwick, like you've just watched the three of them be together. And then the line from Flitwick is, you're late, boys. And it's like immediately it's kind of like that, like Hermione's there too.
Yeah.
You know, like,
But she's not.
Yes. Yeah. So it's like one of those like funny moments where it just kind of like goes from one thing to the next and you're like, wait a second, where'd she go?
Yeah.
But yeah, then what they're working on that day is cheering charms, which I just wrote down as trivia because I'm 1,000% sure I've gotten that question wrong before.
Oh yeah.
So just for those people who like to keep track of important things. Cheering charms.
Cheering charms also stood out to me as like an interesting lesson, because It says, let's see, she could have done with the cheering charm on her too, said Ron as he left the class, as the class left for lunch, all grinning broadly. Because often, whenever they're in class trying to do something, it'll be like, oh, they were trying to turn needles into toothpicks or beetles into buttons. And it'll be like, but no one could do it except Hermione or whatever.
Right, yes.
And it's just like, yeah. But like, they just leave this class and it's like, it just sounds like everyone kind of got it. Everyone did it successfully in one class. Before we couldn't do them, now the whole class can do them. It's like a very successful lesson by Flitwick.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I wonder if this is it's almost like a lesson that like people would like look forward to. Like it's almost like a tiny little mini Felix Felicis type of situation where it's like people really care when that's on the line.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's like, you know, it's like, you know what, we can all do with a little cheering.
You know,
it's been some dark times.
Yeah, you get the feeling that like the fifth years, you know, you get to like the upper years and you're like, there's this week of the year where they're always like the third years are doing cheering today.
Charms, yeah.
Fun day.
That's good. One. That's good. Yep. Yeah. Did Flitwick do the joke about thing?
Yeah.
It's not funny, but you think it is.
But you think it is, right? Yeah. Everything's so funny.
I know. It's so great.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this is a rare occasion where Hermione basically just misses the class entirely.
Yes.
Truly out of form for her. It seems as though she has basically gone back to the Gryffindor common room and fallen asleep on her open arithmetic book. And the boys wake her up and she's like, which lesson do we have now? And then Hermione sadly learns that she missed the most important class of the year for third year. Charms.
Yes. And so this is like a weird time turner problem.
Okay.
Here. Not problem, but just sort of like conundrum when you think about the time turner. Because she says, I forgot to go to Charms. Because you're like, you reading now know that she has the time turner. So it's like, can't you still go to Charms?
Yeah, that's a good point.
But no, she can't.
No.
Because if she did, she would have.
She
wouldn't have missed it.
You're right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because the way that time travel works in the Harry Potter world is everything that happened always happened in the first place. So
right.
Harry's always on the opposite side of the lake casting the Patronus, which is also what empowers him to do it later when he's the one standing there in real time. But you can't go back and change the past because everything just always is.
Right.
This is like one of those interesting things where I remember we were doing a collaboration with another YouTube channel once upon a time, and they kept bringing up the
Bootstrap Paradox.
The bootstrap paradox,
yeah.
Which I think is like the opposite of this particular problem. It's like you can't go back in time and inform yourself because if you did, then you would always know and then you would never go back and inform yourself. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You follow that? So I think that's the bootstrap paradox.
Well, there's no starting point.
There is no starting point. Right. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. But this the way that this world always works is that like it would almost be that if future you like came to you in the hallway and said, do this thing, and then you did that thing, you would also always make the decision to go back in time to tell yourself to do that thing to ensure that you did.
Right.
But you would know that you would because you always did in the first place.
Right. But so like I'm reading this here though, and I'm like, I feel like the reason, like if she had just woken up and realized that she had forgotten, like she could have conceivably like flipped the time turner and then she would have been there.
Right.
The first time. But because Harry and Ron are like, why weren't you in Charms? Like
that
stops it.
Yeah.
Because like now they know she wasn't in Charms.
Right.
So like now, like if she does it, it creates like a paradox.
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
because then
work.
In the future. Yeah. Because then she would have been there the first time.
Right.
Right. But obviously she wasn't.
Yes.
It was very weird.
It is very weird.
It is so hard to wrap your head around this kind of time travel logic. But yeah, like that I feel like is pretty much how it works. But like, because if she'd realized it on her own without anyone else noticing she wasn't there, then they never would have noticed she wasn't there. Because she just would have been there.
Because she just would have been there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I know.
I'm like giving myself a headache.
It's so wimbly wombly. Like whenever we make time travel related videos, I feel like we always have to bust out the huge whiteboards and draw like a million lines.
Yeah.
And ask like 12 people. It's like, does this make sense? Or have we like, are we forcing it to make sense? But yeah. So it is an interesting one. But I think it has to be what it is because it always was.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I feel like sometimes, like, I think you and me have talked about it like 1,000 times, and we're on the exact same page with like how time travel works in Harry Potter, and you'll explain it to other people, and they'll be like, but wait, what about this? And it's like, no, because this.
Right.
And
yeah.
It's like, yeah.
Well, it always makes me second guess myself. I'm like, hold on, have I not thought of something obvious? Am I missing like an obvious problem? Because that's like, especially when it comes to theory writing, it's like a lot of times it's like you're trying to figure out how to make all the pieces of the puzzle work together, but we're not experts in time travel.
Right.
And so like a lot of times you're like, if we hinge everything on this one decision, does that mess up everything? And
it's right.
Like, I don't think it does, but we don't have editors or we have video editors. We don't have like copy editors.
Yeah.
You know, who can be like, no. I spent 3 hours on this. It doesn't work.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, so as we press forward though, let's see here. It seems like at this point in time, Harry and Ron, since they are now friends with Hermione, are finally being like, I think you're doing too much.
Doing too much, you feel a little burnout over there.
You are potentially overextended.
Yes.
And to which he says, no, I'm not. I just made a mistake. To which I highlighted and just said, relatable.
Relatable.
Yeah.
I also, she said, you're trying to do too much. I was just like, I know the feeling.
Yeah.
I know the feeling.
Yes. Yes. Been there.
Been there. You know, this week is going to be one of those weeks because, lest you guys have forgotten, we are heading on tour.
We are indeed. Yeah.
We are heading on tour.
Over to the West Coast for the run of Seattle, Portland, Sacramento, Berkeley, San Diego, and Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Yeah. For that big, that big laundry list.
That laundry list kicks off on September 21st, and I cannot wait for it. Is going to be so much fun, but it does mean the weeks leading up to it are busy.
We need time turners.
Some time turners would be real handy this week.
Wouldn't be so bad. Lie.
Yeah.
Through the Gryffindor, sponsored by Shopify. Boy, howdy, where to begin? I remember graduating college and having aspirations of becoming an entrepreneur. I was brimming with ideas. A kitchen tool that made spiral cut hot dogs, or a phone case that uses a special retractable cables to wrap around any surface for selfies. I had no idea how to make these ideas a reality, and spoilers, I still don't. However, what I have learned through my various other endeavors is how to take products and make them available for purchases online, thanks to Shopify. Shopify is an e-commerce platform that makes designing your webpage, setting up your store, and making your first sales a breeze. But the best part is that after that first sale, Shopify scales with your growth, meaning it's perfect whether you're selling tens, hundreds, or even thousands of products monthly. And I am a data person, and boy does Shopify have data. Want to know how many hot dog spiralizers you sold between May 29th and July 5th? That's peak hot dog season. Boom, data in no time. Also, the answer is zero. I still don't know how to make a hot dog spiralizer, but if I did, I would know exactly how to sell them. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout that we use with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/griffin. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/griffin to upgrade your selling today. Go to shopify.com/griffin to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/griffin. Through the Gryffindor is sponsored by Rosetta Stone. Y'all, when I was in high school, I took 4 whole years of Spanish under Senora Dickerson, no less. And yet, despite all of this energy invested, countless vocabulary tests and oral exams, I simply wasn't able to retain the language. And now into adulthood, I've fully and completely caught the travel bug and would love to see more of the world. And to be prepared for it, I have a whole new appreciation for actually taking in a new language, which is where Rosetta Stone steps in. As the most trusted language learning program, it's available on both desktop and app and truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, ensuring true retention along the way. Rosetta Stone uses an intuitive process that allows you to pick up the language naturally, first with words, then phrases and sentences. The huge milestone for me, though, is the moment you can actually think in another language. Like, how cool would that be? So don't put off learning that new language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Through the Gryffindor, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
Actually, I wouldn't even mind some of what they go to in class next, which is the divination with crystal balls.
Yeah.
You know, even if it could be like, hey, in 2 weeks, this is the theory you're going to be talking about in your video. Like, I wouldn't hate knowing that.
Nope.
Yeah.
Wouldn't mind it.
It is kind of interesting, I suppose, that this book, and I've never really put these two pieces of the puzzle together so much, but divination, seeing the future, is a really big deal. But then time turnering, which is reliving the past,
yeah,
is also a big deal.
Yeah.
So it's kind of fascinating to me that we've kind of got this like duality of the flimsiness of time.
It is. It is hilarious that maybe this like helps inform why Hermione thinks Trelawney is like such a buffoon, because it's like Trelawney's trying to like predict the future while like Hermione like literally knows 3 hours into the future several times a day.
True.
You know?
True, true, true. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point.
Yeah.
It almost makes, and now I'm wondering about the teacup thing, whether or not there's any world where Trelawney is using a time turner so that she knows the teacup will break.
Oh my goodness. That would be a real parlor trick.
Wouldn't it?
But there'd be two of her.
But one of them could just like sit in the back.
Right. This is the thing. Yeah. People are like, Hermione's always like, think about what you do, Harry. Like, if you saw yourself, you'd be like, I think I was going mad. And it'd be like, yes, Harry would. But like, if you, Hermione, saw yourself, you wouldn't think you were going mad. You know exactly what's up.
That's the big thing. Yeah. Like it's, and she explains the danger in a way that like makes you think like, oh, I get that. That's a good point. Like if all of a sudden I was sitting in this chair and then I walked into the room and was like, hey, dude, come with me. I'd be like, what?
Huh?
Like, no, I don't think so. Man, that's so weird to think about now. It's like kind of giving me the heebs. But Trelawney as well, I mean, you know, if this is like a trick that she does year in, year out, it would just make sense.
Oh,
she, man. I mean, she could just park herself in the back of the room, like, you know, because she always comes through like all the
shawls and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. She could just like blend into the furniture or something.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
Boy, that would be so weird. Is it, yeah, if she
is Trelawney.
Could it work though? Could it work?
Let's see here. Now we have to reverse dissect ourselves. So, what would you have to do?
So the one teaching the class would be the one who came back, right?
Because Harry can't perform the Patronus on the other side of the lake until he's come back and already witnessed it from the other side.
Right. So that's because that would be the informed version of you. But how would you get the information the first time?
That's a good point.
Right, because they'd be in the same room. So I don't exactly know how it would work. It feels like if I think about it enough, maybe it can work.
We're going to have to give this more of a sit down.
Yeah.
Because you're right. Like you would almost, it's the same thing we were just saying, where it's like, because everything always happens the way that it always does, it's like, how can you have like witnessed it in real time without having had to experience it in real time?
Right.
Like it would almost require there being like a prestige, like the movie Prestige, kind of like switcheroo that happens where they like exchange places at some point in time.
Right.
During that first lesson where it's like she disappeared into the back and then came back.
Oh, you're right.
You would need like that line.
Right.
So that like it's, you know, she went to gather some supplies or something.
Right.
So, okay, maybe we need to do it.
Okay. Yeah. Is there like, yeah, is she time turning back there or something?
It would be interesting. But anyway, so we're doing crystal balls and once again, we have another one of these kind of fascinating instances with Trelawney where it's like she obviously comes across as so ridiculous and I can't help but side with Hermione's stance that she's just a fraud. However, like as they stare into the crystal ball, of course, you know, she comes over to look at Harry's and right away what she sees is a giant black dog.
Yep.
You know, and it's kind of one of these things where like the story has done a great job of kind of like luring us to this belief that the visual of the giant black dog is the Grimm. But it's like it actually could be showing Harry the future. Like what she's seeing is serious.
Oh, I know. This is absolutely like you know, because whenever she sees big black dog, she's just like, that's the Grimm. It means these terrible things. And it's like, she is seeing big black dog. She's just misinterpreting it as the Grimm.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
So there's that. Also, not for nothing, but they totally skipped fire omens. You know, you're supposed to do that.
Wow.
Just, you know, she said that at the beginning of the year and she's like, nope, crystal balls. Forget it. Palmistry. We don't need fire omens.
Maybe this is a Dumbledore's big plan situation where the cheering charms wasn't meant to happen on this particular day, but Dumbledore is going in and being like, hey, the boys could use a little pick me up.
Mm-hmm.
Cheering charms.
There we go.
They need to know some of this other information. Crystal balls.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not serious about that assertion.
It's just,
you're right though. Where are the fire omens?
Where are the fire omens? You know, she said it. She put it in the syllabus.
I'm dying to know.
Skipped it.
Ugh. darn. That was the one I was excited for.
I know. What could they have learned? What could they learn? Probably that Sirius was coming to get them, as everything seems to be telling them. Let's see. I love, though, this is another great moment for Hermione in this chapter where she says, "The fates have informed me that your examination in June will concern the orb, and I am anxious to give you sufficient practice." And she's like, Hermione's like, "The fates have informed her." Who sets the exam? She does.
What an amazing prediction.
Like, yeah. Hermione has like no F's left to give.
None whatsoever. Yep. No, you're absolutely. She is just on fire today. Really, really shooting from the hip, which I love from Hermione, because she has, because she's just so smart. So she can do so. And it'd be very effective.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Then as we scoot forward, we have another one of the predictions from Trelawney that starts to take shape.
Yep.
Which is that back at the first day of class, Trelawney kind of cryptically depicts that, or predicts rather, that one of them will be lost in Easter.
Let's yeah, see here. Around Easter, one of our number shall leave us forever.
Right, right, yes. And this is kind of like, it sounds so ominous at that time, especially with Sirius Black on the run.
Yeah, and sounds like someone's going to die.
It sounds like someone's going to die.
Yeah.
But in this particular instance, what it means is that Hermione is giving up.
Is giving up.
Yeah.
She's taking like, Ron's advice. She's like, "I'm doing too much."
Right.
"This is pointless."
Right. I'm out. Yep. So the whole class's amazement, Hermione strode over to the trapdoor, kicked it open, climbed down the ladder out of sight. To which I just wrote, Hermione having a pretty wild and empowered kind of day.
Dude, this is like, this is such a great Hermione chapter. It is, all around. She forgives Ron. She punches Malfoy. She quits divination. Like, she's doing it all.
Yes, yes. She's all over the place. All over the place.
Yep. Let's see. And then Harry looks back at the crystal ball, sees nothing but swirling white mist. Had Professor Trelawney really seen the Grim again? It's like, yes. Would he? Yes. So, or not the Grim, I guess, but the big black dog.
The big black dog, yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Let's see here.
And then we have a little page break here, and we head to the Easter holidays, which are not exactly relaxing. The third years had never had so much homework. And I'm like, come on, wizard professors. You're giving homework over breaks? Come on now.
I know.
Everyone knows that's a taboo.
You know, and
you don't do that.
But honestly, I would be willing to bet that this sentence is said in every book going forward.
It is.
Like some version of the fourth years have never had so much homework. The fifth years with their OWLs have never had so much homework.
Mm-hmm.
The 6 years with their NEWTs have never had so much homework.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, I think this will continue, which also reminds me so much growing up in every single school year. I felt like when I was in first grade, my teacher would be like, you know, you're not going to be able to get away with this in second grade.
Yeah.
And then in second grade, they'd be like, when you're a third grader, like your teachers are not going to be okay with this.
That's right.
And it like a lot of times it was like forgetting to put your name like in the top right corner of like the paper. And it was like, by the time I was like in 11th grade, my teachers were just like, "Hey, did somebody forget to put their name on the top right corner of the paper? Is this anyone's handwriting? Do you recognize this?"
Right.
It was like, if I could go back to my second grade teacher, nobody cared.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Oh, I know. I feel like the other big threat was like, you're going to have to learn how to write in cursive because you're going to have to write all your papers in cursive and whatever.
Yeah.
And it'd be like, but like that one was never true.
Right.
But one, because computers happened in a much bigger way. And then two, but it's like what difference would it make if I was writing in cursive or print? Like, as long as you can read the thoughts, what difference does it make how I wrote them?
Exactly.
You know, like that. I mean, I can write in cursive, but I don't think it was as necessary as it was informed to me to be.
Yeah. No, exactly. I think that was probably partially us living with one foot on the side of this side and that side of computers.
We're the in-between generation, Ben.
We are indeed. It's okay. We'll continue on.
Let's see. There we go. Yeah, you're right, though. It says she was like, it's talking about Hermione's workload. She was usually the last to leave the common room at night and first to arrive at the library the next morning. And it's like, but. You mean like besides the older students, right?
Who are also working their tails off.
Right.
No doubt. Because there's no way in the world that Hermione, even as busy as she is, like there's no way that she is. Well, because Percy gets 12 OWLs.
Yeah.
And he is currently at school. So he is taking as many classes as Hermione.
Well, maybe less now. Because now he's in his sixth year, right?
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. That's a good point.
So he could have like reeled back now into like his NEWT level stuff.
He's in seventh year.
Oh, he's in seventh year because he's head boy. You're right.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. So it's probably all just, you know, whatever he needs to get into the ministry, I suppose.
Just electives.
Yeah. Just electives.
Woodshop, study hall.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, cauldron, bottom, measuring.
Nailed it. Yeah. That's a good one. Thank you. That's a good one. He does have a brief foray into those. Let's see here. There is a couple of kind of funny lines here where, like, Ron has taken over the responsibility for Buckbeat's appeal. He was so absorbed he even forgot to be horrible to Crookshanks, which that's like an image I can sort of imagine, like him like poring over all of these books and Crookshanks just sort of like sitting on his lap and he's like absentmindedly like petting him.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, dang it, I forgot I wasn't supposed to like you.
Right, yeah. Oh, geez.
Turns out
it's almost like I had no grounds to stand on.
It's almost like that from the very beginning. And Crookshanks is like, look, see, now we can both be pals.
Right, yeah.
We're both gingers.
Exactly. Yeah. Wow. And then, okay, we get some like interesting like Quidditch, I guess, tournament rules here where... Wood keeps reminding the team they need to win the match by more than 200 points to win the cup. So just like interesting how the points matter to the Quidditch Cup. Like, I guess your point total per match contributes to your like overall standings.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting because like you could imagine a game like where the Seekers, if they were like really off, like this could almost be bad for teams who have good Seekers. Because like, you know, if like just imagine like Chasers just going back and forth and it's like 450 to 470.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're just racking up points.
Yes, absolutely you are.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels like a weird way to do it too, because then it's like imagine that exact scenario, right? Like imagine you're Gryffindor and Harry's amazing and 10 minutes into each match, he catches a snitch. 150, 150, you know, boom, that's your final score, and you've got 300 total points. Meanwhile, Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw, they have a real, real long match, and it gets up to like 600 to 750, and it's just like, well, in a losing effort, the Hufflepuffs have outscored the entire season of Gryffindor,
right,
you know?
Yes.
It's like, are they ahead because they have more points or behind because they had a loss?
Hopefully it's just for tiebreakers.
Hopefully it's just for tiebreakers, which I guess is what they're heading into here.
Yeah, and I do think in like at least like Premier League soccer, that's a pretty common practice, like for goal differential, like, you know, if both teams have 31 wins or whatever, and then it's like, okay, then it comes down to goal differential to see who gets the seed spot.
Yeah.
Which sort of makes sense. But this is like one of those funny things too, where like Oliver, as ever, is just constantly pulling Harry aside. And he's like, now you need to remember, we only win if we're more than 50 points up. And he keeps like reminding him of it. And I'm like, this is really not that complicated. Like,
yeah,
it's complicated the way that like all of the specific rules, like if you don't understand Quidditch, come together and stuff. But it's like, otherwise it's like, hey, we got to be up by 50.
Yeah.
Like, just remember.
And just remember.
Like, yeah. So, I mean, Harry's response, which is in all caps, "I know, Oliver," Harry yelled, to which I was like, oh, snap, man.
Oh, man, everybody's snapping.
I know. This is like a big chapter for people's aggression coming out. But yeah, so Harry's like, okay, I got it. Now, which is going to set up for a very interesting game of Quidditch.
It is. Yeah, it does make it a lot more interesting that they're like, the point differential is like so important.
Yes.
Now.
Yeah.
Which you would think in a 6-game season total that like, point differential would matter frequently.
Right.
You know, like if you're a Hogwarts captain, you need to be like trying to run up the score in every game, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. Like, you know? That's almost one where it seems like more what he should be doing on a regular basis. Like, now, Harry, even if you see the snitch, maybe give us some more time.
Right. Yeah. You've got the firebolt. Let us just keep scoring.
Right. Yeah. Nobody's going to beat you to it.
Right.
Let's see here. But yeah, so then the other kind of like interesting thing is that it seems like the entire school has sort of like caught on the tension between the Slytherins and the Gryffindors. And in so many instances, it seems like Malfoy's like sway over like the gen pop at school, so to speak, seems rather significant. Like, it seems like, you know, like with the Potter Stinks pins and stuff like that, which I guess, you know, to be fair, like Harry shouldn't be a champion versus like Cedric, and maybe people are feeling the same way towards him, where it's like, oh, come on, Harry again.
Yeah.
But it seems so often like Malfoy does this like really good job of almost like rallying people against Harry.
Right.
Like it's almost like as the school bully, he's actually like does have tremendous, you know, influence in this regard. But it pretty much seems like everyone is on the same page that they want Slytherin to lose.
Yeah, because I guess they've just sort of been dominating the Quidditch Cup for so long.
Right. And maybe that's a piece of it too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is interesting though, because for now, the entire school is united basically against Slytherin, but like 1 year from now, like it's funny that like it's not always Slytherin. Like, eventually, like, Slytherin and Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw are all like, Cedric.
Yes, you know? Exactly. Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. So it's like, it seems like most of the time Harry's not benefiting from this mood shift amongst like the rest of the students.
Right.
But in this particular instance, it seems like really, I mean, Harry's got like the full support of the whole school.
Yeah, basically. There is a sentence here though. I just want to point out, it says Harry doubted whether any of them, even Wood, wanted to win as much as he did. Now it's just like, no, I don't think that's true.
I know. Yeah. It's bold of you to think that you could care more than Wood, but I'm pretty sure that this is the only thing that has ever mattered to Wood.
Only thing ever. Yeah. This is his last game ever, basically, you know. Right.
Yes.
Before he goes to the practice squad of Puddlemere.
I know. Yeah. Good times.
Yeah. And then it's also, but it was the matter of Buckbeak that made him most determined to beat Malfoy. And I'm like, really? Okay. All right. That's what's motivating your Quidditch play? Not just wanting to win?
Right.
The Buckbeak thing?
All yes, right. Yes. Which is kind of interesting because it's Quidditch that is motivating his desire to learn the Patronus. And so it's almost like Buckbeak takes the top of the cake there, where it's like Buckbeak, Quidditch, overcoming Dementors.
Right, yes.
You know, in that order. It's like, huh.
Right. I need to learn how to fight Dementors so I can play Quidditch. I need to win at Quidditch because I'm mad about Buckbeak.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then somewhere way, way, way down the line is like, Sirius Black?
Sirius Black, he's still here.
Right, yeah.
You know, whatever.
Right.
He's out there. I guess he's probably trying to kill me or something.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Which on that exact note, it says, Wood had given instructions that Harry should be accompanied everywhere. And I was like, yeah, because Quidditch is definitely the thing that should require Harry to have companionship, not, you know, the murderer on the loose who wants him.
Wood had given instructions that Harry should be accompanied everywhere in case the Slytherin tries. But yeah, I love how Wood is now basically coaching the whole house.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, I got 7 people on the field, but you know what? The rest of you, we're all in this together.
Right, right.
Let's go.
Yep. Let's see here. So then I think that we are getting to the night before the big match.
Yes.
Where
another great Hermione moment here.
Lay it on me.
I think so. Where basically it says all the usual pursuits were abandoned in the Gryffindor common room the night before the match. Even Hermione had put down her books. I can't work. I can't concentrate, she said nervously. I love how into it even Hermione is.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
It's like, you know what, Ginny? I feel like you're just wrong a few books later here. Like, Hermione cares.
She cares. She cares. You know? Oliver Wood is crouched over a model of the Quidditch field in the corner, just kind of like, you know, moving figures around, which I think is just kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But then we've also got a line here where it's Angelina, Alicia, and Katie were laughing at Fred and George's jokes, which this is like one of those things like where I feel like I've been noticing it more in this read through that like the Fred and George / Angelina like companionship, like they actually do have like a little bit more backstory. Like sometimes I felt like when it got to Goblet and I think it's Fred who asks her to the Yule Ball, I was just sort of like, is that just like a token? Like, hey, we're on the Quidditch team together. Like, why not ask each other? But it's like, they do seem to spend like a lot of time together. There does seem to be like this like established like rapport.
Right. Like, I mean, they probably all have classes together and stuff all the time.
Right. Yes.
You know,
exactly.
But it sounds like maybe they're a little closer than like Ron and Harry are with Lavender and Parvati.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So anyway, then finally the night comes to an end with Wood standing up and yelling, "Team, bed!" And Harry sleeps badly.
Yeah, yes, he does. Has a real interesting dream as per usual, where Malfoy's riding a dragon. This is like one of the few dreams which just seems like it's a straight up anxiety dream and not some sort of like magical, like, fortune dream.
Well, you know, it's interesting you said that because
my
main thing here was just like that the riding of the dragons is like potentially foreshadowing for the first task.
I guess that's true.
You know, I mean, that's going to be like one, you know, up into Harry's fourth year there, but like he will have to ride his firebolt against the dragon that is spurting flames at him. I mean, Malfoy's not riding it,
right?
So maybe that's the leap there. But I was like, okay, like we are gonna see Harry v dragon.
That is true.
You know, vis-a-vis the firebolt. Let's see here. And yeah, Harry wakes up. It was a few seconds before he remembered that the match hadn't taken place yet, and then he was safe in bed, and that the Slytherin team definitely wouldn't be allowed to play on dragons.
Yeah.
They definitely won't be.
Yeah, nope. Yeah. It is interesting how, like, in other matches, so much emphasis has been put on, like, the Slytherins have the Nimbus 2001s. Harry has a firebolt. And it's like, that hasn't come up nearly as much this time.
Right.
It's like, whereas Harry having the firebolt was like, that's all the confidence we need to smash Ravenclaw. But it's like this time it's like, well, who knows what could happen, Harry? I know you've got a firebolt, but whatever.
That's where you almost have to wonder if like the firebolt is sort of like a balancing act where it's like the Nimbus 2001s are better than the rest of the Gryffindor's broomsticks and they all have them. And the fact that only Harry
has the firebolt
and plays rather singularly, like he's not like a beater or something that can be like flying from one end to the other, just like knocking people back down. And forth.
That'd be so interesting if Harry was a beater instead of the seeker and he just had the firebolt and it's just like, oh my gosh, Potter is knocking everyone off their brooms, you know.
You'd make a fire beater.
Yeah. That'd be so funny.
That's our next what if. What if Harry was a beater instead?
Yeah, right? Yeah. Oh, boy. That's it. Everyone's just cracking skulls out there.
How much would it change?
How much does Dobby's rogue bludger not matter?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. It's just literally Harry knocking it away and it immediately zooming back at him and him knocking it away again.
Right, yeah. It's just like batting practice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's almost like at that point, it's almost like an advantage because it's just like, whack it and it comes right back. Who do I need to hit next?
Yeah, that's like a boomerang.
Yeah, that's like a boomerang. Yeah. Mm. Oh, well.
But in the meantime, before the Quidditch match is able to start, Harry does see an animal of some kind prowling across the silvery lawn. And here comes that crystal ball prediction
indeed
coming to fruition, which is basically Harry for the first time spotting not the Grim but a cat, accompanied by a gigantic shaggy black dog.
Yeah.
To which I was just like, Trelawney just continues to nail it.
Yep. Also, even before that happens, what I think is interesting is that it's like we get like a description of the grounds where it says the grounds are still quiet. Not a breath of wind disturbed the treetops in the Forbidden Forest. The Whomping Willow was motionless. It looked as though the conditions for the match would be perfect. It's like it almost feels like the school itself like understands the stakes.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
It is like, everything be still.
Be chill.
One thing matters today.
Right, right.
Hogwarts students, you know.
Yes, yes. It is this match for once and for always.
Yes.
Until next year.
Yeah, next year.
Well, not even next year.
No, not next year. Yeah, you're
until
right.
2 years from now.
Exactly. We're going to grow a maze here next year.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Be great.
Yep, yep.
Yep. But then, okay, there's an interesting line, though, here. Yeah, so we see Crookshanks, and then we see the big shaggy black dog, a.k.a. Sirius, and Harry is, like, confused as, what did this mean? If Crookshanks could see the dog as well, how could it be an omen of Harry's death? And I'm like, now, well, have we been assuming that the Grim is like a only Harry can see it thing the whole time? Like, has he been under the impression that it is like only visible to him? Because that's what it sounds like.
It is what it sounds like. I suppose it's kind of complicated to know because like if you were looking for like omens, they might not be things. I mean, it might be a type like, you know, if you had like if it was in your tea leaves or whatever, you might like see it and like show like your friend and they might also be able to see it. But I guess it's almost like maybe one of those things where it's like if you think you're seeing it, like it's almost like your brain is like creating the image in your head. Like,
right.
You know, like if you're looking, it's kind of, it reminds me of like Up, you know, the movie, the Pixar movie where they like look up at the clouds and they all look like babies or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you see babies when that's on your mind.
Right.
And all of a sudden it kind of like clicks into gear a little bit. So I don't know if like maybe that's like a piece of like what's happening. It's like, he's not really seeing dog shapes. Like he's seeing dog shapes. Like they're like, he's finding the patterns in the abstract,
right,
versus
sure.
like actually seeing it. So I don't
like
know.
Like at this point, he's not sure he's really seen a dog.
Maybe so.
Because I mean, he would have encountered him at least twice now.
Right.
At the night bus and at the Quidditch match.
And in both instances, you do have the situation where like with the night bus, like Harry sees it like coming out of the hedges. And then like, as soon as the night bus arrives, there's like the, you know, what you looking at?
Yeah.
And it's like, it, like Sirius is gone in that particular case. And then the other time is like in the top of the stands during the Quidditch match.
Yeah.
And against Hufflepuff.
Yes.
And then like when he like looks back, it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, like after like a crack of lightning. So that does sort of like almost suggest like maybe it's a little figment of imagination.
But that means that like Grimms are not like real creatures. They're just like, you know, things you could see.
Yeah, I think in a way that's sort of what I think.
Okay.
Like I don't think the Grim is going to hurt you itself.
Right.
It's more of like the indicator that like something is coming.
Okay. All right.
Death's footprint.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just making that up. But
all right.
That's my thought. But either way, Crookshanks can see it. So that's making Harry feel a little bit better. But then by the moment that Ron is able to go and take a look out with Harry, it seems like everything has vanished. Just like always. You know, it's like, oh, come on.
It's like, did you know Harry was looking?
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Like, there's no way. But, you know, this is like the moment you start to realize that, like, Crookshanks and whatever this dog figure have some kind of a rapport with one another.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, though, as the day begins properly, they enter the Great Hall for breakfast. There's a huge wave of applause for Harry and the rest of the Gryffindors. The Slytherins are hissing loudly as they pass, which is so very Slytherin with the snake mascot.
Right. I love how it says that Malfoy looked even paler than usual. It's like Malfoy's at like one of these moments where he really has to like put his money where his mouth is all of a sudden.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That is like one of those like glorious things that like occasionally does happen in high school where it's like you're on the spot now.
All right.
Good luck.
Yeah. Prove it or lose it, dude.
Yep.
Which I mean, I guess he did beat Ravenclaw at least
this
year.
That's true.
Right.
We do get a little good luck, Harry, called Cho. That's kind of like one of those big moments where you know, it's like Harry did just beat her, you know, in Quidditch. So it's like the fact that she's like kind of rallying behind him. There's a little bit of building blocks for a relationship that goes nowhere.
I know, it doesn't go anywhere. Harry doesn't respond, though. It's just Cho talking to him, which is interesting because it does make you feel like, is she just like, you know, is it all about Quidditch or is she like seeking him out? Like, does she maybe like him already a little?
I think so.
That
would be my read.
Yeah, I think so too.
They sort of caught each other's attention because even when Harry does eventually ask her to the Yule Ball, it always reads to me as if she is like, she is a bit disappointed that like Harry didn't get first.
Right. It's sort of like, oh man, I liked you, but then like Cedric asked me and obviously I'm saying yes to Cedric. Come on. Have you seen him?
Right. Yeah. Plus he's so nice. No, I know. But yeah, that was, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about it a ton in Goblet, but that's one of those situations where like they're just going to the ball together. That's not like being engaged.
Apparently it is, Ben.
Well, I know. Yeah. It's like, sometimes I'm like, guys, it's going to be fine. Like just go to the ball with Cedric, have a good time, maybe dance with Harry while you're there.
And that's the thing. It's just like, she's going to the ball with Cedric. It's like, doesn't mean you guys can't still dance together.
Right. Yeah.
Doesn't mean you can't. Yeah. And you then, guys and dating now? Come on.
But then afterwards it's like, well now she's Cedric's girlfriend. It's like,
yeah, now this is the thing, you know, she's just like I got to bring Cho down to the lake. You know, it's my most important thing.
Of all things.
That's it.
Kind of newly discovered, but yeah, let's not submerge her under, you know,
exactly,
a mile's worth of water.
Feels like maybe there was a greater setup for like Cedric's dad to be down there or something.
Yeah.
That would have been a lot more tragic, I think, you know?
It could be.
Could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
You know, imagine like that just shows you that it's more of like a two-way street with Cedric and his dad there. And then, you know what? I kind of wish that's what had happened.
Yeah, it's not so bad.
I'm being honest.
It's not so bad.
Yep.
Anyway, plenty of cannon fodder for our Goblet of Fire conversation. Okay. Let's see here. Then as we scoot forward though, we basically do get out onto the Quidditch pitch. We get a line from Wood where he says, "The ground's fairly hard. Good. That'll give us a fast kickoff." To which I was like, this feels so irrelevant.
I know. I was like, is that a big concern or
right, like it's like they're going to share that same
advantage,
good kickoff
or disadvantage,
like, and it feels like within 5 seconds of being in the air it's gone.
Like,
you know, this is not a 100-meter dash,
right,
where like the takeoff matters,
right? Like maybe those 5 seconds are really important, you know, if I don't know, you know, I guess they have faster brooms.
I mean, maybe, you know? Like, I wonder if that's almost like having like a rolling start a little bit where it's like, you know, you can hit top speed in X amount of seconds, but the faster you can kick off can almost like get you to top speed faster.
Maybe.
So I don't know. But sometimes I usually imagine Quidditch starting with them all already on their brooms, not on the ground.
I guess it doesn't.
Yeah, but maybe not. Anyway, though, then you also see that 3/4 of the stadium is all lit up with people dressed in, you know, scarlet rosettes, waving scarlet flags, Gryffindor lions, brandishing banners with slogans like "Go Gryffindor," "Lions for the Cup."
It's surprising that like the other houses would still dress for Gryffindor.
It is surprising. It seems like you cheer for them, but maybe not dress for them.
Right. Yeah.
I agree with you. But then it does say, and this is kind of like one of those weird wizard population lines, but behind the Slytherin goalpost, however, 200 people were wearing green.
Yeah.
To which this is like one of those, you know, like whenever we've done the math, and we're basing it off a very small sample size, but it's the very simple idea that if you have five Gryffindor boys, five Gryffindor girls, and you extrapolate that across the four houses, then it means 10, 10, 10, 10, which is, you know, 40 kids per school year times seven is 280 kids in the total school. So, I mean, you're extrapolating off of a very small data point,
right,
and making big assumptions, but it seems unlikely to me that there are five Gryffindor boys and like 30 Hufflepuff boys.
Right. I mean, it's if there's 200 Slytherin students there, like just they're like based on Harry's class size, there should be roughly 70 Gryffindor students. Right?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the thing that seems so odd about this, or maybe it makes sense, is that like what we've brought up in the past is that probably the other houses were being impacted by the first Wizarding War,
yeah,
a lot more than the Slytherin. So it is possible that the Slytherin house is oddly lopsided.
Yeah.
And that might even be explaining their dynasty a little bit.
Right.
Like, they always win the house cup. They seem to always win the Quidditch cup. So it's like they might just have a huge talent pool if they have 200 students in just their quarter, you know, in their house.
That almost like definitely confirms that, because it just doesn't seem like there are 200 Gryffindor students. Like there should only be about 70, but this is like concrete proof of 200 Slytherins. And it's like, it is what we basically theorized that, yeah, like the Slytherin house, most of their families were like the Death Eaters and they were like the more winning side of the war
at that time.
And like, if not for Harry, you know, those were the families that were being less affected.
Right.
So their families are more in a position to create more like kids and students that go to Hogwarts that still get sorted into Slytherin. And so it's like it makes sense that Slytherin house is just bigger overall, which then, yeah, it gives you a bigger talent pool, gives you more students who can earn points, gives you more students to farm good Quidditch players from.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, so it really, when it comes down to it, it all sort of makes sense, even if the 200 people seems radically high,
yeah,
given the situation. But it also might suggest to us that a standard school populace would be closer to 800 total students.
Yeah.
Which I think is also an important information to keep in the back of your mind. Like maybe the numbers are way down from what they once were.
Yeah.
But that would be like what the school would look like in its most complete form.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Yeah, then you get Lee Jordan's commentary, which, especially as a kid, this was something that I was enamored with.
Love Lee Jordan's commentary.
Yes. It's so amazing. So we got the Gryffindors come out and he says, Potter, Bell, Johnson, Spinett, Weasley, and Wood, widely acknowledged as the best team Hogwarts has seen in a good few years. I love the fact that this is like one of the rare occasions where somebody on like the, you know, the air quotes, like good side is getting the megaphone.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's just sort of like all of the bias during the Gryffindor Quidditch matches is Gryffindor leaning.
Yes.
And it's just kind of like, we don't get to always see that. So it's like,
no, you don't. You do eventually get like the opposite of that when Zachariah Smith takes over the commentary and he's just like real negative about everything.
Right.
And he's like a very non-Hufflepuff person, you know?
I always think of him as a Ravenclaw.
Yeah.
And it's like, he's not, but you know, it's in my head. It's like his name even feels Ravenclaw-y to me. It seems pointy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like Hufflepuff names always sound like roundy.
Right.
To me.
Yeah.
I don't know how or why that's the case, but they do.
No, I know exactly what you mean. You're
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Let's see though. So we have Captain shake hands. Flint and Wood are basically trying to break each other's fingers. And then Madam Hooch starts the game, does her like lone useful thing. And we are off.
Yes, yes. And the Quidditch is upon us. And basically for Harry as well, it's basically like the second that he's in the air and his hair flies back off his forehead, like the nerves leave and the thrill of the flight kind of kicks in. And he's sort of back into gear.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, like, you know, now all the nerves are over. Now we're in it. Now let's go.
Yeah.
And we get some just like really good commentary, which, you know, this is like another one where I just like love Jim Dale's narration. And I listen at 2x speed as well. So it's always,
oh wow, yeah.
It's always really fun to get like, and it's Gryffindor in procession. Alicia's been in the Gryffindor with a Quaffle, heading straight to the Slytherin goal post. Look out, Alicia. Oh no, Quaffle intercepted by Warrington. Warrington to the Slytherin tearing up the field. Wham! Nice bludger, but you know, it's just like,
yeah.
It's like, it gives you that feeling of of actual sports commentary, like where it's just such an art form of delivering in the most succinct way possible the action that's happening on the field.
Yes.
You know, it's like you got to describe a lot of things really quickly to let like the person who can only hear what's happening know what's happening.
Yeah.
But right away, Gryffindor goes up 10-0 with is it Angelina?
Yes. Right. Boom. Yeah. She scores 10-0. Yeah. There you go. Boom. And what's impressive here is that the Gryffindors like are still like all the Slytherins are still on their 2001s, which like a year ago was really putting Gryffindor like in a bad spot. But now clearly like despite the broom disadvantage, they are still outflying the Slytherins.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yep. That might be like an argument to where like innovation in sport kind of like lifts the playing field for everybody a little bit. I don't know if that's a widely held belief or not, but it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could also be though that Slytherin's strategy here is clearly just injure the other team or like stop them. It doesn't matter. Don't let them get ahead by 50.
Yes.
Is their strategy. But it seems like it almost backfires because it hurts their Nimbus 2001 advantage because it just sets up lots of penalty shots instead, which means that a lot of the points come down to keeper skill.
Right.
Versus like, you know, maneuvers and strategy and stuff. So despite their efforts to stop the Gryffindors from getting information and stuff, they're just like giving away their advantage, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Yeah, it's definitely not like it's not the cleanest way to go about things. But this is another instance though where it so often feels like Madame Hooch is always like looking the other way when opposing teams are doing something that they're not supposed to be. And in this case, it does seem like, you know, penalty shots are being handed out fairly.
Yeah.
So it's like penalty shot to Gryffindor, penalty shot to Slytherin, you know, then it's just like,
yeah,
you know, whether or not the keepers can keep.
But then it seems like they're also like really trying to utilize their beaters in a very offensive way.
Right.
Kind of like, you know, because I think at some point they're going to like on the next page, it's like both the Slytherin beaters like aim bludgers at Harry, like at the same time.
Right.
And like they both just narrowly miss. And I think eventually they're going to like aim them both at Oliver and basically just like 1-2 him.
You know, even that though feels like a bad strategy on behalf of the Slytherins, because like even if they're like okay with losing, but they don't want to lose by 50 points, it's not smart for them to inhibit the best seeker at the school, because like if Harry sees it, there's always that possibility he just goes for it.
Yeah, that seems dumb.
Yeah.
Right.
So it seems like almost everything Slytherin is doing in this match is like a little self-defeating.
I mean, the knocking out of Oliver is maybe their only smart thing, where it's sort of like, it's like the like, pass interference sometimes in like football, where it's like, you know what? Like you gave up a penalty, but you did stop a score.
True.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where it's like, and this is like the same thing. It's like, well, you knocked out their keeper. Like, you gave up a penalty shot, but he still can't play.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So you get to see a lot of stuff like that going on. There's a scene where, who is it? Is it Montague? Let's see here. Yeah. Montague was still there and Chaser had swerved in front of Katie. And instead of seizing the Quaffle, had grabbed her head.
Yeah, ouch.
Yeah, which is like, I mean, I can only imagine, especially if they were going in different directions, how quickly this could have like just yanked you off of your broomstick and caused you to go into like a free fall. But
yeah,
Madame Hooch rings out the whistle. They get the penalty shot and you get another like classically Jordan 30-0. Take that, you dirty cheating.
Yeah.
And you get McGonagall sort of like cutting in. Jordan, if you can't commentate in an unbiased way.
And it's like, well, I'm not really big unbiased. That is what's happening.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm telling you like it is, Professor.
Yeah. Fact.
Yes.
Fact.
Yes.
Yeah. So then they aim the bludgers at Harry. They both miss. Let's see. Where is it? Wood starts losing some of his composure as well. Flint along starts. It's Jordan here. He says, "Poke him in the eye, Angelina." Yeah, that's
pretty funny. It was a joke, Professor. It was a joke. Oh no, Flint in possession. Flint flying towards Gryffindor goal post. Come on now, Wood saved. Ah, but Flint scored. That's an interruption. Cheers from Slytherin end. the fight between McGonagall and Lee Jordan is really, really funny. That's going on. Because you can just sort of imagine, like, like she is clearly has some responsibility over setting up this task and is supposed to oversee how it's going, and it's not going how it's supposed to be going. And McGonagall's like, we can't do that, Lee, stop it.
Yeah. Even though she eventually also just breaks down her composure.
I know.
As well here. So let's see. We get another score, and then again the this is where the Slytherin beaters are like really doing their thing. Where like what is it? Katie scored. Fred and George Weasley swooping around her, clubs raised, and it's like in their moment of hesitation, the Slytherin beaters just like take advantage of it, and it's just sort of like, yeah, Fred and George, what are you doing? Gonna get back into the game, man.
Seriously,
no time to celebrate. Let's go, because then this is like costs them like. It says they hit the bludgers at Oliver and they hit him in the stomach one after the other. And then it just says he's completely winded. I'm like, that? He's only completely winded after being hit by both of them?
I know.
Like, I'm like, I'm sorry. Oliver is like out for the game probably, right? I guess not. But
I know. Yeah. It's like, I mean, yeah. That's the kind of thing where it's like, I don't know how much the bludgers way.
Right.
But in my head, they are just literally enchanted cannonballs.
I know.
To which point it's like, Oliver definitely just broke all of his ribs.
I know, exactly, right? Yeah. Like, this makes it sound more like they're just sort of like softballs or something.
Maybe like softballs.
Which is to say, they still really hurt if you get hit by a softball.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. Yeah, it's like, there's nothing soft about a softball.
There's not.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not going to hurt as bad as a cannonball.
That's a good point. That's a good point. There is a difference to be made there.
But then there's a penalty where you can only hit beaters at the... Bludgers at the keeper if the quaffle's in the scoring area. Just like, oh, interesting rule. Okay, cool.
Yep, good to know.
Good to know.
But let's see here.
So let's see. Harry, like now Gryffindor's ahead by 50. So all of a sudden the whole audience is watching Harry and he can like feel them watching. He sees the snitch and he speeds towards it, but Malfoy jumps off his broom and is hanging off Harry's.
Yes.
Which is crazy to me. One, because how does he even pull this off? It says Harry put on a huge burst of speed, but suddenly the firebolt was slowing down. Like, I'm sorry, like how did Malfoy keep up with him to do this at all?
I have no idea.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, it must have been the case. Like, because, I mean, I in my head, Malfoy has always jumped off of his broom and is literally hanging off of the back of Harry's.
Right.
But I almost have to imagine that he's still on his broom. Otherwise, it seems like Malfoy is about to fall.
Yeah, it does seem like that.
Yeah.
Also, for what it's worth, this foul is called blagging.
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 How about it?
There you go.
Okay.
Yeah. Fun fact.
Then we get another good Lee Jordanism. You cheating scum!
Yeah.
And then it even says Lee Jordan was howling into the megaphone, dancing out of Professor McGonagall's reach. You filthy cheating!
Yeah, Professor McGonagall didn't even bother to tell him off. She was actually shaking her finger in Malfoy's direction.
I know. Yes.
It's just like the what is it? The like fever pitch is rising here.
Absolutely. Yeah, yes. Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Things are getting hot. So I just wrote in all caps, just like yes.
Yeah. No.
Like I love a good McGonagall sort of like it's like the it reminds me of Captain Holt from the TV show Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Like every single episode they would do the thing where he like breaks his stoic character and does something silly, and it works without fail every single time.
Right.
And I feel like McGonagall is exactly the same, where it's like she always is so exactly like so stern, so by the rules, so by the book, like very like methodical and everything. And so like any moment where she like, you know, loses like an ounce of composure in the name of like her passions, which in this case is Quidditch, it's like it's like when you feel like it's like, okay, if McGonagall's doing it, we're good.
You know what, it must be that severe. But let's see, then this is kind of a funny like little section here where like they're ahead and Harry, it says, Harry is now marking Malfoy so closely their knees kept hitting each other. Harry wasn't going to let Malfoy anywhere near the snitch. And then literally like before, like what, the end of the page, Harry's like, you know what? I'm going to abandon Malfoy real quick. It's like the next thing that happens, he's like, I'm not letting me, you're not getting out of my sight. Hold on. I got to go do a thing.
Right. I'm busy. One second. I do just love this, this description of what's going on though, but it says, Harry wheeled the firebolt around, bent so low he was lying flat along the handle and kicked it forward like a bullet he shot towards the Slytherins. It's like, this is sort of like a cool moment, where Like, I think what he is basically doing is becoming a human bludger.
Yeah.
Because the entire Slytherin team has basically, like, pooled to, like, block Angelina.
Yeah.
And Harry is just sort of like, I'm just going to run at you.
I'm just going to scatter them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it works. And sure enough, she scores. And Gryffindor takes the lead by 80 points to 20.
Yep.
But... Yes, but indeed. In the process of doing so, he looks over and sees that Malfoy, who has kept his eyes on the proverbial prize,
yeah.
is now... like,
chasing down the snitch.
Yes, and now Harry is having to rely on that firebolt speed
yeah.
because he is, as it says, miles behind.
Miles. It's like... This is so in contrast with what just happened on the Nimbus 2001, where Harry apparently also like put on a burst of speed, but not enough speed to get away from the Nimbus 2001
yeah,
so that
much.
Malfoy could grab on. This time, Malfoy, which apparently has enough acceleration to keep up with the Firebolt, has a huge lead, and Harry is like, oh.
Right, I know. Yeah.
But it doesn't matter because apparently, even though it's maybe the 2001 has insane acceleration, but not high, like top end.
I could see that.
Yeah.
I could see that. Yeah, because Harry basically just goes full bore and
yeah.
he's got that bludger that we see in the chapter arc coming at him. And it's kind of like down to this final moment. It's like Harry threw himself forward, taking both hands off his broom. He knocked Malfoy's arm out of the way, and
yes.
He did it. The tiny golden ball was held tight in his fist, beating its wings hopelessly against his fingers.
Yep, there we go. We did it. Harry wins the Quidditch Cup. Amazing.
Gryffindor wins.
Woo! Yes, they have Wood speeding toward him, half blinded by tears. I love that. These are all still happening in the air, too. So everyone is crying is what is like so funny about this. Like, who else? Like, I think it says McGonagall's crying too at some point, right?
Yes, I feel like yes. crying into like a flag.
Yes,
or
McGonagall
something.
Was sobbing harder even than Wood. I love even Percy. Percy was jumping up and down like a maniac, all dignity forgotten. And it's just like, yes, I love how into this Quidditch match every single serious character is. Like Hermione and Percy and McGonagall are all just like so invested.
They are.
Yeah.
They are. And then we get an incredible line about Hagrid that just like hits you square in the feels. It just says, you saw Hagrid plastered with crimson rosettes. You beat him, Harry. You beat him. Wait till I tell Buckbeak.
Mm-hmm.
Got a little southern on my Hagrid there.
Yeah, there you go.
But I mean, even that is just like so adorable that like this is something that like Hagrid can't wait to go back and like tell the hippogriff.
Yeah.
Like, can you just imagine him like walking back to the cabin and being like, he did it, Buckbeak. He won.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like Buckbeak doesn't care.
Buckbeak doesn't care.
But
yeah.
like, it matters to Hagrid to get to tell Buckbeak something that matters to him.
Right.
Which is adorable.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's really nice. And then there'd been a Dementor around as a sobbing Wood passed Harry the cup as he lifted it into the air. Harry felt he could have produced the world's best Patronus.
Yeah.
Like, this is another great moment. I think we talked about this before where like there was like the last good thing that happens before like, you know, Sirius Black enters the picture or like the last like happy day Harry has. And like this sort of is like that again. It is like the last super happy thing that is going to happen to Harry before like Peter appears.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. 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 So it's definitely just like a really fantastic moment. This is like still during the era in the Harry Potter saga, like where Quidditch is allowed to matter this much. Like I actually think allowing the win to happen right here, it's like during Wood's seventh year, so it's like he's about to be gone forever. We're not going to have Quidditch next year. By the time it comes back around again, like other things are going to have heated up so much. Like this really is the perfect time in the story, like to have allowed this moment to happen so that you, the reader, like aren't also just so preoccupied with the other major threats at
right.
play. Like
it
gets its moment in the spotlight and it's just so much fun.
Right.
So just such an amazing chapter, such an amazing win. And it does bring us to the end of
it
chapter
does.
15.
The Quidditch final.
Do you have a review for us to
Well, of course
with?
I okay. do, but of course I do. Let's see if I can pull it up here without it getting all wonkus on me here. All right. This is from Plain Jane 97. It says, "Hey, brothers, I love your podcast and all the deep dives you've done on both the podcast and the main YouTube channel. I'm a little behind on the pod and I'm listening to Chamber of Secrets, Chapter 16 right now. Ben is theorizing right now about the unplanned nature of killing Myrtle. Do you think that the diary may have been Myrtle's, but simply wiped of its contents because Tom had to act quickly to make the Horcrux? Thanks again."
Oh.
I know. I was like, because Myrtle's Muggleborn and it's a Muggle shop.
Yeah, I know. I don't hate it.
I know. I read this and I was like, how have we never thought of that?
I know. Yeah. I know. No, I mean, it does make a lot of sense because, yeah, like, you know, he's coming out of the Chamber of Secrets. He's not, you know, I don't think he, I mean, Myrtle's not supposed to necessarily be in there.
Yeah, no.
You know, so he's caught
right,
because
she's
guard.
Just there because of Olive Hornby.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah. So he sort of like pops up and I mean it ends up being somebody who would fit
the bill. Yeah. She is Muggle born.
She is Muggle born. Yeah. So there is at least that going on. But yeah, no, that is really a fascinating thought. And even the idea of like, I mean, and I'm speaking extremely stereotypically here, but like if you were to look at the two characters, like, you know, Tom Riddle always kind of has that like super popular, suave, jockish, you know, handsome, yeah, you know, whatever type of thing going on. And then, Myrtle seems like your case study for someone who would be putting their thoughts into a diary.
Is she? Yeah, exactly. It seems like it seems way more likely that Myrtle was keeping a diary than Tom Riddle.
It does. It does. You know? Yeah.
That's because like if you're Tom Riddle, it doesn't seem like you'd want to write all these bad things down and like incriminate yourself.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, and he wasn't planning on killing Myrtle here, and we don't really get a good explanation for like the it was bought on Vauxhall Road or whatever.
I know, you know? Yeah, which is kind of like it's almost like an unfair red herring because it sort of like takes you off the scent. It's kind of like, oh, it's probably not Tom Riddle then, because like why would it be bought at a Muggle shop,
right?
You know, but then it's sort of like it just was.
Yeah, it's like there's no pomp and circumstance around the acquisition of the diary. But if it was already Myrtle's, then there is some circumstance around it.
Yes, it would make way more sense. Because then basically what you have is somebody whose parents live in the Muggle world. I mean, we don't have anything to specifically plant Myrtle in London necessarily, but I mean, that doesn't feel like a reach.
It doesn't feel like a reach. I mean, Diagon Alley's in London anyway.
Right.
You know, like the family clearly has to travel there to get her school supplies at the very least.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I think the diary fits to me with Myrtle perfectly. Especially even the fact that like then the way that the diary is planted, it's planted on, you know, Ginny, who then is kind of writing in a diary in a more similar capacity that I would envision Myrtle doing it. And you know, he doesn't know that Myrtle's going to be there and he kind of acts quickly and it's the first Horcrux that he makes and he needs to do it with something and the diary has never really fit with the rest of them. So I like it.
Yeah.
The only hiccup that I would have is maybe that like at some point in time, Ginny goes and takes the diary and tries to like flush it through Myrtle or throws it into...
Oh, and like Myrtle would recognize her own diary.
Would she recognize her own diary? Because, I mean, she hasn't really, you know, like air quotes, aged at all since becoming a ghost. And if it was a diary she had on her in death, I mean...
She seems more upset that someone threw something at her. So it doesn't sound like maybe she's considered the book itself that much.
And to be fair, any logical person probably wouldn't assume 50 years after the fact that you would be hit with your own small black book.
I know. And I'm trying to think. I think in the movie Prop, his name is like imprinted on the outside of the diary.
Right.
Is that the case? But I don't know if that's a book canon thing.
Oh,
like I'm trying to think, like, is his name on the outside of it in the book or is it just like written on the inside?
The embossing would potentially matter.
Right. I mean, well, you could magically emboss something, I suppose. It doesn't seem like a hard reach.
It's not something I'd be lost on.
Yeah.
What I love about it is that I actually think it fits the scenario better.
I think it does because like, think about how he gets all of the other Horcruxes.
He goes to extraordinary like lengths.
Well, like, I mean, yeah, like he murders Morphin, takes the ring.
Yep.
Right. Murders Hepzibah Smith, takes the other two things.
Right. Yo, you know, you're right.
There's like a pattern of like murdering them and then taking something
and then
from
taking
them.
Something from them. Yeah. Yeah. And that even fits with like his little trophies that he's taking as well.
Yeah.
Like he's got like the yo-yo and the, what else does he have in his like little box of whatever.
Right. It's more like, yeah. Then it's more like a trophy from the Muggleborn he killed with the basilisk.
It totally fits.
It totally fits better. I think it makes more sense.
Yep. Yep. I like that a lot better. So, okay. So we need feedback on that for sure.
Yeah.
That'd be a very curious one, but who was our reviewer on that one?
That was Plain Jane 97.
Man. Well, huge shout out to Plain Jane 97.
I know.
That is an amazing thought. Can't believe we haven't thought of it, but
that's a good one.
That's a good contribution to the headcanon. So
yeah.
Love that.
Yes.
Love that.
Yes. Very good. Very solid. I'm trying to think. He obviously doesn't steal Nagini from anyone, and then the diadem is just found.
It's found, but he also does, like, in a way, you could maybe say the Grey Lady is... I mean, you can't kill her because she's a ghost.
Because she's a ghost,
but
yeah.
She is charmed by him and ashamed by being charmed by him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not a victim in the same capacity, but manipulated.
I mean, he, in a way, like, kills Ravenclaw's legacy, you know?
True.
A little bit.
True.
And it's still a trophy for having been a hidden thing.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. So there's that.
Right.
Yeah. No, I think that fits a lot better.
It does. Honestly, it almost fits in every way better than the existing narrative, which is not written in, you know, print either. Like it's not like we ever get the story. It's not like during any of the flashbacks we ever get some concrete, clear discovery.
Yeah, I know. It's not like we know that Wool's orphanage was on Vauxhall Road,
which would help. Yeah,
yeah.
That would make all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, that one sentence alone, I'd be like, oh, there you go.
There it is. Yeah.
Like, you know, easy answer, but we don't have that. So it's like, yeah, this is better. Okay, cool.
Bam.
Yeah, perfect. Well, I think that concludes today.
I think it does. Thanks, as always, for your reviews, which, guys, we are over 1,000 reviews. So thank you so much for your continued support. And if you haven't left a review, I mean, please go do it. You know, that really helps out the podcast, helps us the discoverability and all that. And we, you know, there's always such great questions from you guys in there.
I know. Yeah. That's like one of the greatest things about doing this show is it feels like it's, you know, as much as we might be the people talking, I feel like there has been so many incredible contributions from the community.
I know.
Like
you
got like, you know, if we are helping to expand your knowledge base of the fandom, it's like we can also express our gratitude back to you for doing the same.
For like, yes, helping illuminate corners of it that we haven't seen yet.
Yes.
Yeah, which, you know, sometimes like from, you know, doing what we do, that it feels impossible, but it I mean, obviously it's not.
Yeah, case in point.
Case in point, this one and almost every other question we've gotten.
It's been able to bring about so many new theories, so many new what ifs. So
No,
it's just been, honestly, I know that, you know, we're still just in the middle of
the third book.
Yeah, of the third book here.
Long way to go.
Yeah. It's been I can't wait to see what else comes. So
I know.
I have a feeling it will be quite a few things.
All right. Well, make sure you join us next week for chapter 16, Professor Trelawney's prediction here on Through the Gryffindor.
Today's episode was edited by Ethan Edgehill. Vaishon Brandon does our art. Catherine Stein is our production manager, and the show is hosted by me and Jonathan Carlin. Through the Gryffindor is back, and this time we are heading to the West Coast. Join Jay and I as we record brand new episodes of the show live in person with you guys, plus a special in-person Jay versus Ben with questions asked by... This September, we will be heading to Seattle, Portland, Sacramento, Berkeley, San Diego, and Los Angeles. Seattle and San Diego were both sold out, but we've just added matinee shows to both locations. So if you missed out on the first pass, or if you want to join us for a doubleheader, we will have two unique shows in the same day. For us, there is nothing more fun than getting to nerd out Harry Potter style with each and every one of you. And we will also have exclusive Through the Gryffindor merch and a VIP meet and greet available for every show. We hope to see you all there. Ticket links can be found in the show notes or at supercarlinbrothers.com.